You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Hello and welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast about all things theatrical. This is Rob Weiner-Kent, senior editor. I'm here with my colleague
Eliza Bent, also a senior editor.
Exactly. And We have a new issue about to hit newsstands and a lot of stories online. A March issue. On the cover are the civilians who are part of a story by our colleague Deep Tran about theater and museums. So civilians are the artists in residence at the Metropolitan Museum. So it's a great shot of them at the Temple of Dendur at the Met, which is don't see many performances there. In fact, it's just a one night only thing they're going to do. I think it's in May. Is that right?
Yeah.
The other big story in there is about drunk Shakespeare, basically. troops that have made drinking a part of either the performance and or the audience experience at Shakespeare, which harkens back to the way it was originally done, somewhat.
A lot of opportunities for puns.
Lots of them.
Shakespeare is one of the companies.
So let's see. Chat about some of the things we're thinking about working on. What are you working on right now, Eliza?
I'm working on a couple things. A front and center preview about a Australian a new play by an Australian playwright that is premiering in New York. Kind of a rare thing. We often get Australian plays that are brought to us.
Right, full production.
That maybe Cate Blanchett is involved with.
Usually she is.
For example.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But this playwright, Alexandra Collier, points out that it is the rare case that a new Australian play gets its premiere in New York, or in the U.S. for that matter. So working on that, and then also a strategies about the idea of having the Friday matinee.
Ah, yes.
Friday matinee. And shouldn't more people be making a Friday matinee?
What company is doing that?
That is the ever-delightful New Georges.
Oh, right, sure.
Yeah. So they have experimented with this in the past and have had great success attracting all members of the creative class to Friday matinees.
Is that the idea because people are sort of more inclined to take a half day on Friday anyway this weekend?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a little bit of, like, it's an incentive for the theater goer to cut out of work a little bit early, you know.
Always
the
like
theater
that.
Agent, perhaps even the theater journalist.
Perhaps so.
This journalist has been known to scoot out for a Friday matinee on occasion.
Who knew that the new frontier of experimentation, or one frontier of experimentation in theater, would be showtimes? Because I've noticed this in New York. You know, there's that line in Angels in America where Roy Cohn is talking to people on the phone.
Obviously, I don't know that line.
Well, he's setting up theater tickets for people, and he's like, the theater's always at 8. It's 8. Like, it's like, and he goes, fucking tourists. So, like, you know, it's like, the theater's always at 8. I mean, you pretty much could set your clock by that.
Yeah. The only Angels in America quote I know is, "You burned my dinner."
Which one's that?
Isn't that like Harper and dinner has been burned?
Joe.
Somebody was recently telling me about that. Somebody was talking about
a
college scene. But yeah. Anyhow.
Anyway, so yeah, curtain times. Are changing all over. I check regularly to make sure it's not a 7 or a 7:30.
7:30. I don't know. The half hour gets me. I like it on I like a full hour. What is that called?
A full hour interval?
An hour interval, as opposed to, you know, 7:15, 7:45, 7:30. I get a bit...
7:45, I haven't heard too many of those, but...
Yeah, I guess that's true, but...
It's at the Fringe Festival or something. Yeah, no, so this Friday matinee, why not? You know, why not do theater whenever?
I love a 9 o'clock performance, or a 7 o'clock too.
It's
a civilized time. Then you can really have a nice dinner that you're not doing an early bird thing, or have a nice performance and then have your kind of your evening to
I think Hedwig has a weird schedule. I haven't been to see this broad. I saw Neil Patrick Harris in the original.
I saw Neil Patrick Harris as well in the original. It was a late night performance.
Oh, really?
And I remember my beloved and I were traipsing around because we had an awkward amount of time to kill. We ended up getting a massage.
Is that a good idea to do before a show?
It actually was such a bad idea because then I felt oily and like, I mean, I was like, super relaxed, but it was a very weird frame of mind to see that show in. And, you know, it's like you're covered in lotion. I mean, far be it for me to complain about the joys of having a massage, but it was a little strange. And then I remember I got the playbill. The playbill was, like, stuck to my leg.
That
it was very cold
thing.
In the theater.
Well, so, you know...
Oh, it's tough to be
a 10:30 show or something?
It was a late evening. And I also am known to take a doze often in the theater. You know, it's it's an easy place to nap. Dark,
it's
cozy.
It's cozy, right.
But what else do you want to talk about?
You know, there were other things I was going to mention. Oh, the big interview today is with just a dialogue I had with Isaac Butler.
Mm.
Director,
love a dialogue.
Pundit, and very opinionated person about equity in small theater. And he's been on
equity,
the front,
like actors equity.
Actors equity, that's what I'm talking about. Okay. And he and I have talked over the years about The Flea. He's not a big fan of their volunteer company, The Bats. He's been out in front on that debate. Also, the New York Showcase Code. And when I see the debates about that, I recognize a lot of the same issues that come up back in my theater hometown of Los Angeles, where they have that 99-seat plan where actors can work for many weeks without much pay. And many actors feel they should have the right to work wherever they want, whatever their union status. And other actors are like, that's a raw deal. We should be getting paid a minimum wage. So Isaac and I talk about the ups and downs of that whole debate. You're chuckling because you have been a performer as well.
No. I'm just cackling at all of the jokes that I want to make about about so many things.
Tell me, Eliza.
Well, about, like, he's not a fan of the Bats at the Flea, and I would... I guess... Well, and then also the idea of actors getting paid, like, the oldest profession that goes unpaid. This is why I have my musings writ large across my face, but not actual jokes that I can deliver.
I understand. I mean, I get the sense of talking to you over the years because you've been a performer.
I am
an ensemble member. You are a performer and a playwright.
Yep.
You've directed and produced plays, and I get the sense over the years talking to you that you wish that there were more opportunities to just do that and self-produce and not have to worry as much about the equity rules. Maybe I'm mischaracterizing.
Oh, sure. I mean, well, like, I feel like it almost becomes, like, two separate debates in a sense. Because certainly producing anything is very hard.
Yeah.
And there should, of course, be more opportunities to produce. And people should make more opportunities for themselves to do that. But it's a real headache and a nightmare, especially if you're also, like, artistically involved, I find.
Yeah.
Because producing is its own art form in and of itself.
Yeah. Sure.
But in terms of the equity stuff, yeah, what a nightmare. I mean, I have been involved in a bunch of things that are Equity Showcase and a bunch of things that are not Equity Showcase.
Right.
Everybody should get paid. But I don't think that that's really new territory.
Right. I think the question...
So I guess what's the... Yeah, what...
Well, it becomes... People should get paid in the sort of passive voice of abstract, like they should get paid whenever they work. What if they create the work themselves? Should they pay themselves? Should they...
Of course. Pay yourselves. I don't know. I took this marvelous, marvelous seminar a couple of summers ago.
Yeah.
It was called Artists Summer Institute. It was through LMCC, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and Creative Capital. And it was this free lottery thing that you applied to, and I randomly got into it. And it was great because it was theater folks, but visual artists, dancers, projection people, really a cross mix of art-making people. And they had all of every day was devoted to, like, one was strategic planning. One day was all about financial planning. One day was how artists can use the internet better. Mm-hmm. And it kind of all sounded like, oh, geez, do I really want to do this? But it was fascinating. And one of the biggest things that they said, I remember, on the financial day to everybody in the room who had some stakes in the arts was whether you're a visual artist selling your paintings or a playwright producing your own plays, it was when you make a budget for the thing that you're making, always put a line item that you're paying yourself.
Right,
if you don't respect yourself enough to pay you,
right.
Then like, what does that say about the art you're making?
Right.
Which again gets problematic when, of course, you know, whenever capitalism enters the art marketplace,
it
becomes a little bit compromised, right? Because nobody's really making theater to make money.
Right.
And you're doing it because you love it, hopefully.
A few people are making what they're really, quote, worth, right? Whatever that
is. Oh, gosh, right? Of course.
Yeah.
I would be making theater
anyway,
no matter what. Right. I happen to live in New York City where there's more emphasis, I think, on kind of like monetizing or professionalizing.
Well, there is a marketplace here.
Certainly. Yeah, but if I was living in Greenland, I would be making theater there.
Sure.
And it would probably be a really different producing model.
Yeah.
If you will.
Yeah, I guess.
Who knows? Maybe it's... I don't know a lot about Greenland theater, so...
It's interesting. Isaac and I don't get into this too much, but L.A. people who like this plan the way it is and don't want it to change because Equity wants to change it, try to talk about L.A. like it is a different country. Like it is a different market.
Well, it is certainly a different country.
It's a state of mind.
I don't know about that old country.
Don't knock it till you try it.
I quite like California.
LA is an interesting place. I had to grow to love it.
So what's the issue? People just are mad that they're not getting paid, or...
Oh, it's so, you know what it is that there are so many actors there who created a situation where they basically sued their union in the 80s to let them get on stage with almost no protections.
That was a great idea.
Well, it has, but what it,
I'm sure it made a lot of sense back then, but
what it did was created this amazing scene where people could just put up a play. The overhead is much lower because you don't have to pay as much to actors.
Mm.
It created so much more work than needed to be on stage, really, by any economic measure or even aesthetic measure. Mm-hmm. But there was so much to see, and I grew to love so much of the theater I saw there.
Sure, what a wild way to experiment,
exactly.
There's so much. There's
so these they became nonprofits. They incorporated.
Right.
They created, you know, little quasi careers for people. Some of whom weren't paid. Some of them paid a little bit. I was just making a list of people I saw on stage there in this scene. This is before they were stars. Mark Ruffalo and Nick Offerman and Anna Gunn and like Jack Black. All these people started in that scene not getting paid anything. And then they weren't necessarily seen on stage. You know, it wasn't like a showcase, but they've since gone on.
I think the same is so true in New York in terms of, particularly in terms of, certainly perhaps the Flea. I'm not super, super well versed with the Bats Company.
Yeah.
But look at all of the improv theaters. There was that big article a couple of years ago about UCB not paying its people or the Pit not paying its people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the opportunity to perform on a weekly basis, that's an education in itself, right there.
In front of really smart audiences.
In front of audiences, period. The fact is that there are audiences there, which is more than can be said about most experimental theaters in the city. I say that with all love of experimental theater. So it is a sort of weird catch-22 because on the one hand, it's, I think, invaluable for a performer to get that much stage time. On the other hand, it does become this ridiculous thing where, as a performer, you're paying for a rehearsal space, you're paying for, like, an improv coach, as the case is, and I say this having been on one of these like weekly teams or whatever that performs.
UCB, really? Yeah.
It was at the Pit actually
years ago.
Years ago in my younger life, but and I remember pointing that out, and it was not a politically wise thing to point out at the time. I was like, oh, wouldn't it be great if we were like getting paid for this? And the management was not happy with that little question.
Yeah, I don't know what the business model is at the Groundlings, for instance, in Los Angeles.
I don't know,
because you take classes there and you become a member. But that's where I first saw Will Ferrell.
I mean, it's a lot of buying in, of course.
Yeah.
But then it's also you're getting, I think for a lot of, you're getting tons of exposure out of it. And truly,
right.
It's, you know, I didn't go to acting graduate school, but I genuinely do think of my time at the Pitt and being on like a house team there as an MFA program, like a sort of street version of it.
A little cheaper than one, right?
Certainly a lot cheaper and really fun.
Isaac and I get into many of these and many other issues.
I wish I can't wait to hear what you and Isaac talk about.
I can't wait to rehear it. So we're going to go to that interview now. We'll come back afterwards with a couple recommendations. Here we go. Here to talk about the controversy over small theater plans and equity with Isaac Butler. Tell us about yourself, Isaac.
Yes, hello. My name is Isaac Butler. I'm a freelance writer and the senior editor of the Perception Institute, an anti-discrimination think tank. But you probably know me through my writing for American Theater, through co-founding StageGrade, and through the blog Parabasis.
Good, good. So, and you're someone who I know. We've never really talked about this topic. Maybe we've Facebooked about it. And I know you've been very forward in your thoughts about the showcase code in New York.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen those debates and sat on the sidelines for a lot of those. In Los Angeles, just to set the context, there's a showcase code on steroids. It's called an LA 99 seat plan. And it allows equity members to work in small theaters under 100 seats for almost no money. Basically, in New York, it's a MetroCard stipend, but they can only work for about 16 performances, give or take.
Right. The showcase rules are actually very, very strict and very limiting. And from what I can understand, the 99-seat plan, which is a plan, not a code, has it's sort of olly-olly oxen-free in a lot of ways.
Well, it is, but you know, of course, the history of it is that it's been overlaid over what used to be a total waiver. Not a total waiver. I believe the equity waiver was still there was a seating limit of under 100 seats. I mean, with the sort of logic that at 99 seats, no one can make a ton of money,
right?
Unless they're charging $1,000 a ticket,
which the market wouldn't bear.
Right. Exactly. So. No one. This is where things get sticky. So I wrote a big story about this because in Los Angeles, Equity has stepped up its efforts to, you know, scrap the plan basically, or turn the plan into something which looks like a contract, and would be a contract, so that Equity members can get paid. Now I know that I wrote the most recent piece from a personal point of view because. You know, in my experience, I've covered LA theater for, 20 years. I saw everything from the large to the small and didn't really discriminate in quality. And I saw some amazing, amazing work. New playwrights, classic work, large casts. And I certainly was aware that, I'm not getting paid much, but boy, these actors aren't getting paid anything. So it didn't seem like it was sustainable. And there were tweaks to the plan over the years, but I'd heard these rumors about, the plan was only in place because of a lawsuit that the members, some members had filed against Equity, to basically give them the right to self-produce and get on stage for nothing. Equity didn't like it at all. Now it looks like Equity's putting forward a plan to completely, change it,
right?
So that there's not in any way a waiver, not really even a showcase code anymore. It's going to be minimum wage for every hour the actor puts in on the job. So I wrote the piece with my own personal perspective, but also wrote it to help explain to people like you who are New York based and, from what I gather, pretty pro-union, which I'm not saying I'm not pro-union. I've talked too much, Isaac. Can you tell me, did the piece help explain to you a little bit about where...
Yeah, totally. And, I've heard from friends who are largely stage actors in L.A., meaning that they, when they act, they're usually acting on stage, which means they're usually acting under the 99-seat plan. about how upset and terrified, frankly, they are about these changes. So I have some sympathy to that. Right. And I think what you were trying to capture in your piece is that is this idea that, you know, equity is responding to a real, legitimate exploitation problem. But the way that they are responding is going to have a lot of consequences for a lot of people. And you can decide that those consequences are worth it to get to the solution or not, but you can't ignore that those consequences are real.
Right.
And, right. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's an artistic director out in San Francisco, and he, you know, the guess is that should these changes go through, LA's theater scene will start to look a lot more like San Francisco's theater scene. Which is to say there's sort of these large institutions and then there are these smaller theaters that have like an equity member per
show.
Yeah,
right, like a letter agreement or something.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he was saying that neither side in this fight seems able to acknowledge the validity of what the other side is saying. You know, the people who want to keep the plan the way it is seem to be pretending that there's no problems with the 99C plan, mm-hmm, or that mm-hmm. it isn't exploitative to ask someone to work for 6 months and get paid $7 a performance, you know? Basically that equity doesn't have a legitimate grievance when they obviously, I mean, I just sort of think on a principle level that argument is ridiculous. And then, but on equity standpoint, they seem to not be, they seem to be acting like, you know, everything's going to be just better at the end of this. And it's not going to be better for everyone. There are people right. that it's going to be worse for. The question I have that I still find myself mulling over is this. Let's say these changes go through. Okay, you can probably predict in 5 years from now what the consequences of those changes will be. Some of the organizations that are producing under the 99C plan will go out of business. Right. Some of them will raise money to institutionalize a little bit more and graduate to the next level so that they can continue using equity actors. Right. Some of them will use fewer equity actors and will have to pay the minimum wage. Some of them will use non-equity actors. And there will be less incentive for people, for stage actors based in LA, to join the union or maintain their membership. And so the membership of equity actors in LA will shrink.
Right, right.
Now, just talking purely logically here for a second, right?
Yeah,
and I don't want to ignore the emotional valences or that these are people's life's work that we're talking about. People have spent decades building these companies. Like, let's just set that aside for a second. I don't want to act like that's not real. But all of those consequences seem mixed to positive to me. Equity has too many members who don't work under equity contracts, really. You know, and as a result, their effectiveness as a union is diluted because their rule changes and plans and everything like that have to be subjected to a vote that itself, you know, there's a huge voting block that aren't working regularly for pay.
Yeah.
You know, and that hampers equity's ability to be an effective representative for its members who do work with some regularity for pay, which is what they exist to do. You know? That's what a union is about. You know, you wouldn't ask a boilermakers union, you know, or the, a plumbers union to subject all of its, you know, procedures to out-of-work plumbers. You know, it's just like, that's just what unions are for. So some attrition in the ranks might be, in the long term, a positive thing. Some of these companies starting to work with non-union labor might be, like, some of these things strike me as positive. People who want the 99C plan to stay the same, though, constantly pretend that non-union actors don't exist and that they're not real, like that that's fictional or a construct or something. But the truth of the matter is, you know, it is not that no fly-by-night experimental, you know, low overhead inventive companies, it's not that they can't exist. It's that they can't exist and not pay union actors. And those are two different things.
Right.
So So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
My personal opinion is that Equity is responding to a very, very, very real problem, and they're clearly, it was very clear from as you laid out in your article, that they're really fed up with the status quo. You know? But
yeah.
They might be... Well, they might
I want to push on that. Yeah,
maybe
go on.
Maybe overreacting, or maybe reacting too swiftly, maybe not creating a plan that allows yeah. some kind of transition so that the
right.
people who are behaving well, the good guys and gals, the good companies, can survive it. You know, like, it seems like maybe there were better or more, at least more pragmatic ways to go about doing this to, you know, reward the member, the companies in good standing.
Well, yeah, that's a sticking point. I mean, I think Equity's response to that has generally been, a lot of folks talked about budget
right.
tiers. Equity's response is, well, if there's going to be a tiered system, the bottom has to be minimum wage. If we're gonna, it has to be a contract. It can't be one of these agreements. So that's why they've never negotiated with the producers of these small theaters, because they don't recognize them as producers. Really, they don't recognize them as a collective.
Right, but I mean,
partner.
Is the bottom tier, not even setting aside Showcase for a second? Right, let's talk about New York City for a second.
Yeah,
is Equity's bottom tier seasonal Showcase minimum wage? It probably isn't. No, because that goes by a percentage
no.
of the budget of the show, divided up amongst the actors. So,
right.
I mean, I would love to move to a system where the bottom tier nationwide is minimum wage. I just, and let us just say, it is, can we swear on this podcast? It's
yeah,
fucking absurd that we're even having an argument about whether highly trained professionals, many of whom carry enormous debt loads as a result of getting that high level of training, should be
right.
paid minimum wage or not. I mean, that's absurd that we even have to fight about this. But, you know, at the same time, you know, we do, because there's no money in the American theater system, you know?
Right, right. I mean, to me, I try to step back and look at what the reasoning behind the actors wanting to get on stage, union or not, in Los Angeles, is that it's a self-producing reason. It's to get on stage and do more work than is available. And to
well,
me,
is that the actual reasoning behind it, or is it to like? Because so in New York we have the Showcase code, and that phrase Showcase, you know, has sort of gotten lost. If I may be a constitutional originalist, if I may play, you know, Scalia for a moment or something, the point of the Showcase code was to allow equity actors to appear in things so that they could be noticed by higher tiered people in the industry and hired. It was never meant to sustain the system that it sustains right now. And so the rules, if you read them through that lens, all the kind of rules that people are annoyed by about the Showcase code in New York, they make total sense, because the point of it is not to put on plays. The point of it is to get people seen. And so in LA, do you know, is the sort of original reason behind it the same, or is it?
Yes. At least it's often been put to me that way. You don't hear much about it lately, in part because the scene has now become a way to put on plays. I mean, that's the default. It's a
right.
And also because it's not the most effective showcase. There's more effective ways to showcase yourself. There are showcase nights where people put on short
right.
scenes for cast directors. Also, you know, with some justification, the people who put on these plays for their own sake object to the idea that LA is just a bunch of actors wanting to put on vanity projects. So the word showcase has a dirty. But yes, it was always justified to me by those. The guy who used to handle the 99C plan said, Equity allows this as a sort of showcase. And the idea was, it's much more loose in LA because there's so many more actors. And the supply and demand is so out of whack. I think the supply and demand argument cuts another way, though. And that is that if actors are going to put on plays for art's sake, well, that's fine. But by definition, they have not, there's no economic need for them. There's no economic reasoning for them. And so there's economics that are going to, by definition, be paltry and outside the marketplace, essentially. And
right.
if you're outside the marketplace, and then there's these people in a union that you want to work with, you either make a deal with the union, as actors in LA did, these companies in LA did, or you have to pay them what the union says. And I think there's a certain brutal logic to it that I can acknowledge.
Yeah, I think brutal. I think brutal logic is a really good way to describe it, because again, the consequences in the short term are going to be are probably going to be severe. Like, I'm sanguine about that. I don't want to ignore that. At the same time, there's a weird thing where people want the benefits of working with the union. Both actors and producers want the benefits of working with the union, but they want to be able to do whatever they want. And that's just not how unions work. Unions can't work that way. You can't collectively bargain if individuals are able to choose whatever jobs they want. You can't do it. It does not. It will not work. You know, there was that L.A. Playwrights Association or whatever it's called, and they had that
Alliance
letter
of
and that paragraph.
Thank you.
And in that, you know, one of the paragraphs there, they're saying, you know, we believe people shouldn't be exploited, but we also believe artists should be able to take any jobs they want. And you, that's a fantasy. It's just a fantasy.
Right.
The only reason why actors aren't exploited more than they already are in this country is because of the founding of Actors' Equity.
Right, okay.
You know, like, historically, that's just how it works. You can't have a system where... where, you know, our culture in general thinks that artists should work just for exposure, right?
Yeah.
So there's a devaluing of artists. There's a supply of artists that way outweighs the demand for artists. And then on top of that, you're saying, well, you know, artists should be able to take, you know, any job that comes along. That is just opening the doorway to greater, ever greater exploitation, because someone will always take that job.
But it's there's taking a job, and then there's making your own work. I mean, do you have any sympathy with the idea that actors should be able to self-produce?
Well, what's the matter with the self-producing exemption as it exists in these proposals for? I mean, you have your ear to the ground more there. What is the matter with that self-producing clause? Because Equity was asked to come up with some way to do, you know, to include self-producing in these reforms. Reforms is probably a loaded word for but they did. So what's the matter with what they came up with?
You can't incorporate or be a business entity of any kind. You can't be a nonprofit if you'd self-produce like that.
Right.
And it's basically, if you want to talk about a vanity showcase, actors basically have to completely fund their own work. You could argue that that's kind of how this whole scene started, and then they became professionalized. And now they pay their box office, these little 99 seats here. They pay, there's often someone on salary to run the place, so that actors have, this is, you know, it's a parallel to the argument that we've had about the Flea here in New York, where they have money to pay overhead for rent and to build a giant new facility, but they have an all-volunteer company of non-union actors.
I mean, I think the Flea is a particular case that's a little bit different because, you know, as I said in that piece I wrote about the Flea and paying their actors, you could make the argument in like 2001 when they were really a scrappy fly-by-night operation that almost got closed by 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, like, I see some justification to the argument of like, yeah, we're built on this, we're built on, you know, we're all volunteer. You know, the staff donates back their salary.
Yeah.
The actors work for free. Like, I get that. But once you're talking about an established institution that is being given millions and millions of dollars by the taxpayers of New York to build a new space, just the you have risen to a level where not paying artists is unconscionable. And, you know, like, some of this for me is contextual. Like, you know, you would never, like, I'm on the board of the debate society,
right?
And it's very important to the debate society that we pay our artists and we pay them well. But, you know, like, when it was originally just Oliver and Paul and Hannah, and it was really like the three of them doing almost everything, and they were performing at the Crane, which for, you know, the Red Room, which doesn't exist anymore, for those of you who don't know, is like a place that you rent by the hour and has 40 seats and is now a condo. But, you know, it's teeny, and I used to act there. And so, you know, like, when you're talking about that, it's like, are Hannah, Paul, and Oliver going to raise money to pay themselves? You know what I mean? So I understand that some of this is contextual, but in that context, you're also talking about companies that have existed in some form or another now for a long time. So if they haven't built the support to make this kind of transition, you know, that's that's tough, man. But it, also, why haven't you built the community support?
I guess they do feel that it would have been nice if Equity had worked with them and looked some years out and said, here's where we want to be. I mean, a previous...
Right, which is what I was saying earlier, right? That it's like, it's a little drastic to suddenly flip the switch to everyone has to pay their actors $250
right. There's a handful...
Which is around what the minimum wage would come out to if we're talking about a 30-hour rehearsal week. We're talking about...
Right, I mean, there's a handful of companies that I followed in L.A. that were 99 Scene companies, East West Players, one called The Colony and Noise Within, who... I don't know if it was a different regime at Equity, but if that was the reason, they worked with Equity, and now they're offering, guest artist contracts. They're on some sort of form of contract now, and they're bigger than 99 seats.
Right.
The best spin you could put on is that Equity wants to put this floor in of a minimum wage and 99 seats, and they'll be open to talking to companies and producers if they can at least meet the minimum wage. Do you want to charge more for your tickets? In fact, they've lifted that ticket price cap.
Right.
And
isn't that lifting of the ticket price cap a little bit illusory, because it's not like people are going to pay $75 to see a 99 seat?
No, it's true, but it's a sop. It's some sort of a sop. Like, we're going to lift this cap. Look, and I would love to see them, once they establish that tier, lift the cap on seats and start talking about actual... If you have a hit show in a 99 seat theater, you're not going to make... You're still going to lose a ton of money.
Right.
I guess where a lot of people also feel that when you talk about it as exploitation, objectively speaking, you can say that, but a lot of them say, look, we willingly have created this system and we want to continue it. Who's being exploited if we have willingly put in the time, built this theater, and so on?
Yeah, no, and I think that's a good question. I mean, I think that's a smart question to ask, and I'm sure if you're listening to me saying that, you know, there's exploitation in the system from my, you know, perch in New York City, it probably sounds like colonialism or something that you're coming in and say, do you know what I mean? I get that. This is what I'll say.
Yeah.
I'm trying to articulate here that it is Equity's position, as far as I can understand it from following them on Twitter and reading your article, that there is widespread exploitation within this system.
Right.
It is hard for me. The average Equity member who is in a 99-seat show, planned show, works for 9 weeks and is only paid the $7 per performance.
Right.
Right?
Well,
This is according to them. This is according to them. And so they're whatever. It is hard for me to look at that and say that someone willingly choosing that makes it magically not exploitative.
Okay.
When you create a system where there are no alternatives but working for free, essentially for free or for peanuts, then that's not a real choice. No one's actually choosing anything.
Huh.
If there is no alternative, there's no choice. You know what I mean?
I agree that the system starts to create its own economic logic, and the incentives are in place, as many people pointed out, to, like, why not produce at that level? Now, some companies do pay more voluntarily. Yep. Some pays, and some have to negotiate with actors. But it's true that if the system's floor is as low as it is in L.A., there is room, I would agree, there's room for exploitation, and there have been anecdotal stories. It's just like, there's been no Triangle Shirtwaist Fire incident that has galvanized the community. It just seemed like the union just never liked this, and they just decided we're now going to end it. I mean, look, I will say that over the years, as someone who observed the scene and loved it, I once gave a speech to that community at a conference that said, you need to make less theater. Just stop making so much. Think about what you're doing. There's too much of it.
I mean, that's certainly true of the indie theater scene.
Yeah, yeah.
The indie theater scene makes too much theater, and there's too many people working in it. You know, the supply and demand thing is so out of whack. But then, you know, there's that whole thing of, like, oh, well, I'll put down my gun if you put down your, you know, it's like,
well,
who's going
yes.
to, who gets to voluntarily decide they're going to do less work? I mean, it's
but after
ridiculous.
And after I gave that speech, some friends of mine said, like, look, that show you love last year, that would never have existed without the plan. It's like,
right.
Yeah. And that show and that company and that artist. I also, so I had to concede that. I also had to concede that those artists, the problem of burnout, which you have in theater everywhere.
Yep.
Because it doesn't pay enough. Is huge in LA. If you can't make a living doing this stuff, you can do it for your art for so long, and then at some point you just make a web series, you know?
Right. So, but I guess my question is if there's all these folks who want to do this and they want to sort of just do it for the fun of it, or they want to do it for the personal fulfillment.
Or the art of it. Let's not.
Or the
talk.
Art of it.
Yeah.
No. This is why I did this stuff. Like, people, if anyone's listening to this and thinking that I'm trying to be insulting, I'm talking as much about myself as a director working in New York City in my 20s.
Right, because you directed under the showcase.
You know, these are the reasons why I did it. Personal.
Right.
I directed under the showcase code. I mean, you know, the I probably, you know, the most I ever made on a showcase code production as a director is probably $250. Do you know what I mean?
Right,
so, you
right.
know, I am of you, you know, like I'm
yeah.
indicting myself here. Doing something for the love of it, for the art of it, for the personal fulfillment of it. These are all incredibly wonderful reasons to make art. They are not necessarily the reasons of someone who needs to be in a union while making it.
Yeah, no, I get that.
And I think that there is a way that we see the professional and pro-am and amateur divide, right? So there's the sort of, we think about things as professional and amateur, and then there's the sort of mid-space that I bet a lot of the 99-seat people are in, that I was in, which is this pro-am space where you're kind of doing professional-ish quality work for definitely amateur wages, because, you know, some community theaters pay actors. So, you know, those of us who have fallen in that space, or pro-am, or maybe even am, there's a real existing stigma around that, and a lot of internalized self-hatred and insecurity around that stigma. And obviously, you're not going to sit there at an equity meeting and discuss that.
Yeah.
But I think that there are psychodynamics going on here that it would be humane of us to acknowledge exist.
Yeah.
Which is that, you know, you're looking at someone who's run a theater company for 20 years and, you know, someone is essentially, they hear it as someone essentially telling them, your work isn't sufficiently professional.
Totally.
Therefore, it has no value.
Right.
And regardless of even that's what they're intending to say, because it might not be what they're intending to say.
Yeah.
There is a rich tradition in American theater of non-professional work that has immense value. You
yes.
know, some
yes.
of those, if you look at, like, a lot of the big institutions in New York City, especially the big downtown institutions, I mean, Soho Rep wasn't a professional theater when it started.
Yeah.
It was a group
yeah.
of friends. There's a group of friends for, like, 2 decades.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
La Mama wasn't a professional theater. Cafe Chino wasn't a professional theater.
Yeah. No,
Joe Papp might be the least professional theater maker who ever lived. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I'm joking here, folks, but... But I do think there is a rich tradition of pro-am and amateur work, and that we should also honor that and consider that. And that if some of these companies and some of the folks, I don't know, maybe there's room for us to be more honest about what we're doing and what we're creating that can come out of this. That, to me, would be a silver lining.
I think you might be right. I think that that stigma you talk about...
I feel that stigma.
No, it's definitely part of the discussion at LA Theater. And as someone who loves those theaters, like, kind of unconditionally, the work I've seen, I want to just get past that and go, look, I love your work. We're not talking about the quality of the work. We're not talking about how good it is. But it's hard to get it away from the marketplace and economics.
Well, we confuse money with value.
Yeah, of course. Course.
You know, we confuse money with value, and it's, I mean, as a country, it's not, this isn't, all of these problems that the LA 99-seat folks are having, or that, you know, all the debates over the showcase code, they're really larger political issues in the country, you know?
Right, right.
And what we're really looking at is one of the last places where, other than the schools, I guess, we're looking at, you know, public elementary schools, where the entertainment industry is one of the few places where the unions still have, like, real power, you know? And so anyway, these are real issues. This confusion between what we pay for and what we value is a big one, and it drives a lot of horrible things that have happened to the arts over the past few decades. And to me, you know, the issue, So, I mean, it's difficult. It's really thorny and I am really emotionally painful. And as, you know, someone who's worked in theater for a long time and, you know, the emotionality surrounding this, the human element of it, is something that, you know, shouldn't necessarily be determinative of what the forthcoming policy should
right.
be. Right? It shouldn't determine everything. It shouldn't be the gravity. But I think we need to acknowledge it exists because it's actually exerting a lot of gravitational pull on this conversation.
Yeah.
But that's partly because it's not going acknowledged anywhere. And so it's like the... sorry to use a cliche, it's the elephant in the room, or it's like, you know, it's like...
Well, it's the thing that's being talked about a lot, but is going to have no place in equities deliberations. It maybe shouldn't. I don't know.
Right.
By the logic of...
You are talking... These movements and the things equity is saying and everything like this. And again, I actually am leaning towards... I'm conflicted about it, but leaning towards being in favor of what equity is doing. I think, again, a gentler transition would have been good, but this is good for them to establish this as the eventual floor. I really believe that. At the same time, maybe, you know, transitions, etc., blah, 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 blah. But also, it's just worth acknowledging that this threatens people's identities. It threatens their conceptions of themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, I hope that doesn't sound condescending.
No.
I'm trying to really imagine, like, you know, that point when I realized in my mid-20s that, you know, I'd been a director since I was 16 years old and I had barely ever gotten paid anything.
Yeah.
And that often I was treated, even by producers who were employing me, I had been treated at times like I had no value because they weren't paying me.
Right.
Or whatever, just sort of treated like the work doesn't matter. You know, like... It's a horrible moment to go through.
Yeah.
No one likes to be faced with this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
you
sure,
know?
Sure. Unfortunately, there's no union concession for identity.
Anxiety or threat.
Right, exactly.
But, you know, like, so when I worked in Richmond, Virginia, when I would direct in Richmond, Virginia, and I would talk to the actors there, for example, a lot of actors would just choose not to join the union because there were so few union jobs. Choosing to join the union meant... that they were less likely to get work, and so they didn't do it. And they were upset about that, but they also freely acknowledged that that was a choice they were making.
Right, right.
And to live in a city where that was true.
Yeah.
Right? And to have this kind of career. And so I think what's going to happen is a lot of people are going to be faced with a choice. And that's going to lead to some, you know, as I think you put it on Facebook in a discussion we were having, attrition in the ranks. And I don't know that but is attrition in the ranks a bad thing when the supply of actors so overwhelms the demand for them that it's led to the kind of wage spiral that got us here in the first place?
In theory, that works. But I think that the power that the union gains by having more, more paid up, members with skin in the game, actual rules. I don't know if that translates into better contracts at the few equity theaters in LA, the Taper, the Geffen.
Right.
They're kind of in a separate economic sphere. Like, I think I put in a line in my piece that was kind of addressed to a concern you raised. I just don't see that, like, Antaeus, which employs equity actors, not only pays them the stipends, but actually charges dues. A lot of those actors... are up for the roles at the Geffen and South Coast Rep. Their free work that they do at Antaeus, it isn't really threatening the economy when they negotiate with the Taper, is what I'm saying. Maybe those economies should be more integrated, and there should be more, like, in-between theaters from the tiny ones to the big ones, and maybe...
So what you're saying is that while it might be true in New York that working for free... puts a downward gravity on wages. It's less true in LA because the systems are more stratified?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people complain about the systems being stratified. Maybe one
right.
way to make them less stratified and to get those big equity houses to not only cast from New York when there's all these actors just sitting there, equity actors,
LA. Which is another, you know, another nest of worms.
Yeah. Maybe that's a concession that they could get. I don't know. I totally get the logic of it. And also the issue that the 99 seat plan debate brings up a lot of larger issues about artist compensation and just social justice in general. It does seem weird to some people there that they're focusing on this poor scene and in this what feels like a punitive way.
Right. I get emails from people who have worked in that system who frankly feel that it's a lot more exploitative than you do. And frankly feel that essentially their read on it is that, you know, equity is putting its foot down because they're pissed.
Yeah.
Because the system has been around for a long time. Yeah. And the only thing that's come out of it, not artistically it's come out of it, I mean, you know, what's come out of it is a series of now codified terrible business practices.
Yeah.
And that they're pissed about that, and they're reacting out of anger. That, I mean, again, these are not equity. I want to make it really clear. These are not equity officials who have told me
this.
Is like people who are out there in that scene have written me about it. But then I have other people writing me and being like, you know, if you want something like 13P to exist in LA, it can't exist under this system, under the rules that, you know, this will destroy innovation in LA. And then, you know, just to speak to this conflict, I'm like, oh, well, they have a point. But then it's, you know, innovation is always used as the reasoning behind not paying people what they deserve. You know, when companies talk about innovating, they usually talk about cutting jobs or wages. For example.
It's not a real principled argument, but I would say that there's almost something more clean about just a volunteer system. I think I mentioned the anecdote of a sound designer I know who either gets full corporate rates for what he does or works for free for his friends. He doesn't mess around with penny ante stipends here or there. It's like, I'm going to do this project for love or for money. And
But if that's the clean way to go about it, then actually equity's reforms will bring us closer to doing that.
Yeah, you're probably right, because you can still do those projects for love.
You can still do, it's not like equity is banning, is making it illegal to produce those projects.
And the problem,
you know,
the plan is contained within the seeds of its own destruction, because it's this sort of fake, almost contract with any compensation in it at all. It makes it like, oh, really? That's what you're going to pay me? I need more than that. You know, so it's you know, even folks on the other side have acknowledged that when you start to pay actors anything after not paying them anything, you pay them a little bit. They're like, wait, this is all? When they were happy to work for nothing before because it was all about the art, right?
So, yep. Totally.
Anyway. Totally. I think we probably should wrap it there. Isaac, it's been a great to talk to you.
Yeah, great to talk to you. Great to talk to you. And really, yeah, I mean, it's a complicated situation. You know, I feel a lot of conflicts about it. I'm sure you do, too.
I do, too. That's why I analogize it to a divorce, really.
Yeah, totally. Well, good to talk to you, Rob.
All right, Isaac. Take care.
Thank you very much. Yep, you too.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
And we're back after that epic conversation. So, Eliza, anything you want to recommend to our listeners that they should see, read, think about?
Weren't we going to talk about Hamilton?
We could talk about Hamilton, which you saw.
I saw.
It's been the topic of a few podcasts because I saw it and loved it. And it's been the talk of New York. It's going to transfer to Broadway.
Yep.
But not this season, as was rumored. It's going to start previews in July, open August 6th.
Very exciting.
Did you like it?
I thought it was sensational. It felt like the Shakespeare of our times.
Wow.
It was absolutely riveting. That's
mm-hmm.
using a delightfully dense language in a super accessible way.
Totally.
It's immediately engaging. You have to pay close attention to what they're singing and rapping and talking about. I thought it was sensational.
Yeah.
And I really, really liked the dance moves were out of control.
Totally.
I was tickled by the whole thing. I really was. And Pippa Sue just takes the breath away.
Sure.
And it's so exciting to see the creator of something actually performing his work.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had never seen Lin-Manuel Miranda. But kudos. Kudos, Lin. Truly. If I can, I'm doing to, let's be on a first name basis.
Lin-Manuel, right.
Shan't we? Right. I don't know.
Sure.
I found myself being toggling between sympathizing with Burr.
Oh yeah.
He's
a great character, actually.
Such a good character,
yeah.
And you know, of course, sympathizing with Eliza Hamilton.
Yes.
And of course, seeing a show where my own name is.
Eliza, that's right. That's what I forgot.
Oh, Eliza, I've got so much on my plate. That was a particularly hilarious line.
I'm going to quickly recommend before we head out. Speaking of the LA 99 seat, there's a site called Bitter Lemons in LA, sort of, you know, like Rotten Tomatoes, Bitter Lemons. It's bitter-lemons.com. And it's a review aggregating site, not unlike StageGrade or Rotten Tomatoes. But I have to give props to that site and its founder, Colin Mitchell. That is where ground zero of the LA 99 seat wars is happening. He posts several posts a day about this. If you have any interest in that and in the issues that it raises, I have to give props to him. I don't think I've acknowledged him that site enough in my reporting or in my conversation with Isaac. So go to bitter-lemons.com to read about LA theater if you're interested.
And when you have a bitter lemon, make some limonata.
On that note, another edition of Off Script. Thanks, Eliza.
Thanks, Rob.
All right, bye.